I he's we, and welcome to another season at Scudder Team. Two scholars bringing you in tea. Take it away, Mommy and Uncle Cameron.
So, Shauna, let's spill some tea.
Baby, I'm an iced out necklace.
Fake or real?
What? Oh, real. Oh, I don't do fake anymore.
Anymore, yeah.
Fake it anymore.
And, you know, we were able to do what a water ceremony called Kapukai, and that is a water cleansing healing ceremony. And that was also very transformational for me because it was just being in the ocean is my church. And so I was able to sort of go in and call into my ancestors and call into my guides and just, you know, being set some intentions for myself, for my community and the world, and being able to let go of the things that have been weighing down on me.
Much like many other institutions of higher education, Temple's enrollment rates have steadily declined since 2017. And as an open campus in the city of Philadelphia, gun violence was impacting the student experience. Although I would argue that gun violence is disrupting the student experience across the K-12 and higher education sectors, regardless of location, but that's a story for another day.
Because often when we talk about critical theory, we talk about power in this very dominating way of who holds the decision-making and who is making often decisions that could be oppressive to other folk. But from an indigenous worldview of relationality, power through Deloria and Wildcat's work, they really harness this idea that it's an energy. It's an energy that runs through all beings, both animate and inanimate, that can really encourage change and movement whenever they interact.
What I think about this week and highlighting her is that who she is as a person is who she is in her work.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that. She is a phenomenal woman, truly authentic, very caring. And so I'm glad to hear things like that.
Don't you love when the scholar and the person are congruent? Don't you just
alignment.
Love that?
I love it, yes.
So what's problematic is us not owning our awkwardness. So being socially awkward in these conference streets and not being honest about it. We must normalize that this is something that all of us are navigating. So know the difference between shyness, social anxiety, and awkwardness. So people often use these three terms interchangeably, but they actually mean very, I don't know, I feel like I'm teaching. They feel very different. I feel like I just started class. Okay. So shyness and anxiety can both cause you to feel awkward, but you can also be socially awkward without being shy or suffering from a social anxiety. Hey, hey, hey. Welcome to Scholar Tea. Thank y'all for choosing us in this conference session. For those of you I haven't met, my name is Cameron Carl.
And I'm Shauna.
And we are the hosts of the Scholar Tea podcast. For those of you that don't know what you just walked into, we are going to do a live recording of the podcast. But we also want to frame the work of the podcast and how we see some contributions that we've made since its founding.
Yeah, so we did develop the design for the podcast in 2007 here at ASH, so it's only fitting that we find space to reconnect around the work here at ASH now. It really started because we were just trying to think of different ways to uplift minoritized voices, particularly those of the global majority, because we were just noticing that, at least in higher education, these spaces aren't necessarily geared towards ensuring that we can be our fullest selves. And we wanted to be able to do that in the best ways we knew how.
We sometimes get in an echo chamber and talk only to each other. And I have friends that work in corporate America or in other disciplines that listen to Scholar Tea to understand some of the context of what's happening. But also learning, the people we interviewed continuously drop gems that no matter what field you're in, they're going to offer some perspective either for your work or for your personal development.
Yeah. So that's how we got started. We have a rundown that we usually go through, and so we're going to do that today with y'all if you will humor us a little bit.
So we usually start with a check-in, and a check-in is usually a random-ass question that Shauna and I have come up with that uses an analogy that determines our mood for the day. So we'll do that here in a second. But then we always highlight a scholar of the week or somebody that's a practitioner or a scholar practitioner that's doing work that we want to amplify and make sure that the listeners understand and can go and seek out those resources and that work. We spill some tea. For those of you that aren't familiar with the colloquialism of you know, what's the tea, is really thinking about, okay, what's going on in terms of either context or understanding and breaking something down, or we heard these things in the streets. Is this what this how it's really going down, right? So we usually highlight some topic with our spill the tea. And then we always highlight and interview someone on each particular episode. So today y'all get to hear from Dr. Candace Hall and the wonderful work that she's doing with Cluster Luck. And then I always talk about what's problematic. And what I mean by that is usually something I'm annoyed by and then breaking it down. And then Shauna comes with these jokes of the week, and they become a fan favorite, corny-ass jokes, but they always make us smile and bring a little joy. And then we leave the episode with affirmations and celebrations.
Well, and I usually pick my mood based on my hunger level, so that's how we ended up doing chicken wing sauce once. But the whole point of the jokes of the week is really just to see if I can make him laugh. So whatever I could do to fuck with his mood, that's make him smile. That's really the purpose.
Some of them are good, but some of them be like, girl.
I mean, you gotta embrace your joy, okay?
So our temperature check for today is, what Prince song is your mood on today?
I picked Kiss, because you don't have to be rich to be my girl. You don't have to be cool to rule my world. It's just about the way you love me. And I will give that love back. And so that's how I'm feeling today. That's my mood about you, about the people in the room, and Ash.
I love it. I'm similar. I'm doing Raspberry Beret. If you listen to the lyrics, you know, him and his girl or whatever. This year, I almost fell in love with Ash again in a different way, being here. I've been here since Tuesday, so I'm a little tired and ready to go home. But I also feel restored by the community that we built, by people, to see people, to love people, to want to be in community with people, and to do life with people, right? And to be able to find those people in your profession, I know is a gift. So, yeah.
So we're going to go ahead and move into the Scholar of the Week. Our Scholar of the Week this week is Frank Tuitt. Frank Tuitt is the University of Connecticut's Vice President and Chief Diversity Officer and Professor of Higher Education and Student Affairs in the Neig School of Education, with 25 years of experience as an administrator, academic, and change agent in higher education in the United States and more recently around the globe. Tuitt is responsible for systems-wide strategic planning and implementation of mission-driven institutional diversity efforts. Tuitt's scholarship critically examines issues of race, inclusive excellence, and diversity in and outside of the classroom from the purview of faculty and students. Tuitt is the co-editor and contributing author of 5 books, including Race, Equity, and the Learning Environment, The Global Relevance of Critical and Inclusive Pedagogies in Higher Education, and most recently, Campus Rebellions and Plantation Politics, Power, Diversity, and the Emancipatory Struggle in Higher Education. Please give it up for Dr. Frank Tuitt.
Shout out to Frank. He is in the building in terms of at Ash. So if you see him, amplify and congratulate him on the work that he is contributing.
Well, and it's really special for me because, you know, as a grad student, Frank was assigned to me as my mentor, and he's really held on to me and helped me up. And he's never held any punches with regards to what the academy could mean for people, especially those interested in diversity work. So it's really special to me today.
Nice. Thank you for highlighting him as our Scholar of the Week. So next, we're going to spill some tea. We wanted to talk about the Ash experience, right? Any first-time attendees?
Yay!
Welcome. Shauna and I were chatting about, like, what has our journey been in Ash? Because a lot of people have very different experiences, right? It can be an isolating first-time experience or third, fourth, fifth-time experience. It could also be a place where you find community. So I know I have some bias in terms of what my experience has been. My first Ash was in 2010. In Indianapolis, and I was a doc student at Iowa State University, and it was a cohort of us that came to Ash. And I didn't realize the privilege of like navigating this space with a group of people, especially when it was a little more stuffy back then, y'all. You might think it's still stuffy, but back then it was pretty stuffy in the sense of the way scholars would call out your work in a very rude way, in ways that didn't feel developmental or formative. The first discussant I went to, and she went in, and I'm like, oh, I'm never presenting at this conference. And I would go back and process that with my cohort. And when I thought about that, I was like, well, some people don't have somebody to go back and process that with, and then they never come back to this space. I say that to name that I know that I had a very unique journey. And then this year was my first ASH starting on the board, right? So now I'm like this full like experience within the association that I consider a home. And I want others to consider it a home. And how do we cultivate that in ways that the conference can be fulfilling?
Mm-hmm. And I think mine was a bit more what you would hope to see as the traditional experience, although I recognize it's still not. Like, I didn't come with a whole bunch of people, but I did have a really dope advisor. And so she invited me to come. Her name is Tamara Bertrand Jones. Shout out to Tamara. And my first ASH was 2013. And she was the one that would like, okay, we're going to this session and this session. I'm introducing you to this person and this person. So what you would hope to see in a mentor or advisor, she was the one that would take me around and cut through the bullshit and just let people know, like, this one's mine. You treat her with respect, right? So in that way, I've had a good experience in ASH because I had someone that kind of shepherded me through the process and then demonstrated to me what I should be doing for other people. And then along the way, I met some really cool people too, right? And we have some peer mentorship happening in the space, and that's been really beneficial to me too.
So Shana, what does it mean for folks who don't have access to an advisor or a mentor who can walk them through the meaning-making process of an ASH?
That's the thing I've been wrestling with this conference in particular. I'm not going to be honest, and some people in this room know that because we've been talking about it. And so I'm thinking, how can we be more strategic about creating space for people, especially people that are on the margins, that is intentional and it's like healthy, and one that is bringing people into the space, recognizing that there may be people that are not grounded or don't have a grounding, or don't have someone to turn to back at their institution to make sense of like a really fucked up discussant conversation, right? Like, what ways are we thinking about the people that are often caught in the middle, and then we end up losing a really good, hopeful perspective because they don't see themselves in the academy, and the one place that's supposed to be nurturing that isn't even doing that. So I'm trying to think through like how we can use our positionalities better.
And you and I talked about this yesterday, and also some of it is internalized, right? Mm-hmm. We see somebody get up there and do their presentation, or we see people get these awards, and we're like, oh, the imposter syndrome sets in, the internalized questioning, am I putting worth to a product like scholarship also sets in too. So how do we break internalizing those feelings of imposter syndrome?
I've been real transparent. I know maybe 4 years ago, I had a really rough time at ASH. I'm a practitioner, if y'all don't realize. I am an administrator. I have no interest in teaching. I just don't want to grade papers. It's just not.
I don't need those.
Shit, it's horrible. But it's just not my lane. I've never saw that as my ministry. And so I had a really rough time. And I realized, in being honest with myself, that the reason why I had such a hard time was because I was allowing people to diminish my worth or how I viewed my worth because I wasn't a faculty member, because I wasn't doing certain things that people feel like you ought to be doing all the time. And I was internalizing that shit. And I realized that I was maybe more attached to my identity as a professional in the academy than I realized. And so I also had to pluck that out a little bit more. Like, I'm definitely more than just the academy, and so like, why am I not leading into the other parts of my identity? And once I figured that part out, I'm like, oh, well, fuck this shit, you know, like, I'm good. Like, I know I have something to contribute, I know I have something to offer, and if you don't appreciate it, then that's fine, you know, we're not all gonna be each other's cup of tea. But I thought that was really something that I had to work through for myself, and I think other people are dealing with that stuff too, and they're not being honest about it. So I'm like, okay, well, what can I do to contribute to making sure that that's not being replicated in the future?
Yeah. One of the clips we played, those are like our highlight reels from the year that you heard at the beginning. the scholar and the person being congruent, right? And when you meet somebody and you've read their work and you're citing their work, and then you meet the person, you're like, oh, hold up, playa, like, something is not aligned in terms of, like, you about equity, but you're treating people a certain way. And for me, it was like the internal work of making sure that I'm congruent with my values. Please call me out if you meet me and you don't feel like I'm congruent, because I think that's important. All of us are human, and how do we center the human part of this work? I'm still holding on to Dr. Joy Gassingale's presidential address last year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was such a good year. Mm-hmm. Really what we're thinking through is how can we create spaces of healing in a place that is meant to kind of grind us up from all ends of the spectrum? And so we're going to think through more like how can we use our positionality and different projects and collaborations to create spaces that are actually nurturing, because that's what we're about. And I've never been so centered in my life right now. Like, I'm so zen, y'all. It's so crazy.
She a whole vibe.
For real. You know, cash me outside.
It's too cold.
It is. I just like, no, we don't have to do that. Like, why are we doing that? And I just refuse. I refuse to participate in that. And
you don't have to.
And you don't have to. Yeah. And we're here to tell everybody that you don't either.
Well, that's the tea at this ash.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Cameron did have this really academic thought process, though, about what that was. And I just want you to...
You want me to say it?
I do.
Some of the internalization is like this neoliberalism of higher education and how we internalize, like, what's prestigious, what scholarship, what institutions and research is of value, right? And when we see people doing something or people at another institution, we do sometimes harm to ourselves. What they say, comparison is a thief of joy. And that comparison is rooted in this neoliberalism of higher education. Mm-hmm. And throw that shit out the door, y'all.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So thank you. And thank y'all, you know, for all the work that you're doing.
Scholar this week that we get to be in community with is Dr. Candace Hall, who uses she or hers pronouns and is a creative academic in higher education and student affairs. Her research interests include the recruitment, retention, and support of Black faculty at historically white institutions. Dr. Hall aims to show the possibility of Black joy in the academy and hopes that more people invest in spaces where Black faculty can authentically experience joy, hope, and community. Her recent project, Cluster Luck, a documentary short, highlights the experiences of a group of Black faculty within a department at a historically white institution. The short film unpacks what community means and what it looks like for Black scholars to have supportive communities within their departments at their institutions. Dr. Hall earned her doctorate at Maryville University in St. Louis, and Dr. Hall is an assistant professor of educational leadership at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. Can we please welcome Dr. Hall to Scholar Tea?
So we've come full circle. The first screening of Cluster Luck was at ASH last year in Las Vegas.
Yes.
So what has happened over the course of this time, and how has your work been received?
So, hey, y'all. excited to be here and be on the podcast. Last year, I had a lot of anxiety around sharing my work at ASH, if I'm going to be honest, because we're supposed to be presenting papers, right? Not, you know, playing movies and such. And so I initially wasn't going to screen it at all. I was just going to talk about the work. And JT, my colleague, friend.
Shout out to JT.
In the back, encouraged me. So he's like, no, you should show it. It's a beautiful project. And so I was really frazzled leading up to that. But I'm glad I showed it. I wasn't prepared for the reception, if I'm going to be honest. I was prepared for people to pick it apart in the ways that you talked about when you mentioned the discussant, right? I was prepared for people to think about it critically and to kind of like shred it. I wasn't prepared for people to just take it in and sit with it in the ways that I think people in that room did And so since then, it's been a whirlwind, a lot of things that I hadn't expected. So traveling across the country, sharing the work, being in conversations with people about how this work translates in their own context, how they can think critically about what community could look like for their Black faculty on their campuses, how they can think differently about recruiting them all together. It's been a blessing and a joy and a little overwhelming. So sometimes people are like, why are you so nonchalant or have like a blank face? And it's because I'm still just trying to process it all, just thinking about all the things I've been through in my life and sort of negative messages that I've heard about who I couldn't be or who I wouldn't be. And to be in this space now, I'm just eternally grateful for people that have invested in me along the way and the courage to follow my gut. And even when my gut is unsure, having that community of people who will constantly remind me of who I am and what I'm capable of.
I remember you as a doc student. So to see you, and it's like you're walking in your purpose in a way, and you're a model, especially for young scholars or doctoral students that want to reimagine the academy in a way. I'm just so proud of you. So I just want to say that.
Thank you.
So talk to us about the hopes that you have for the film as you think about digital archiving and building content that lasts in perpetuity.
Right now I'm trying to figure out where this lives, right? So I'm happy to continue to travel with it, and also it needs a home because I have other projects I want to work on and give my full attention to. One of the things I hadn't really considered until last year at ASH, a conversation I was having with Dr. Will Smith and Dr. James Satterfield, as they watched the film and they know my dean, right? It's like, how beautiful is it to have her legacy documented in this way? And I hadn't thought about it like that, right? I was just thinking, like, we have community. This feels good. I feel like people should see how lit it is. But I didn't really think about now, forever in time, marks this commitment that she has had to not only recruiting us, but supporting us in these roles and investing in us as people, not just as a faculty member at the institution. And so as I think about archiving this work, capturing other things, so you may see me with the camera in my hand sometimes, or people following me with a camera or documenting moments that may feel a little awkward. And the reason is I want to make sure people know that we were here. And so, you know, sometimes I'll document things and somebody will be like, no, this is not a moment to film. Like, no, I'm not going to use the audio, but I want people to know that we are here in the academy. And so one of the things I hope that my work does generally is make us more visible. We are more than the less than 6% of Black faculty that is a part of, you know, whatever data set. But we are people. And so I hope my work humanizes us in that way and makes us visible.
And I know you have an impending project that is very exciting, I think, but also, listen, sis is just a vibe. And the creativity that flows out of you. I'm so excited. So you're thinking about like how the future can be for people that reside in bodies like ours. And so can you talk a bit more about that project and what that might mean for the academy?
Yes. So I shared this story Wednesday when we, Charles and I, launched the project at CP. And so I like to share where kind of the idea came from. Last year, I nominated JT for an award with ACPA. And so once I was notified that he'd be a part of the Diamond Honoree class, I was like, hey, bro, you need a new headshot. I love you, and you need a new headshot. And I am very particular about photography. Like, I will take headshots, like, 2 or 3 times a year. There's something about, you know, a fresh aesthetic. I don't know. Anyhow, made him take some headshots. Once they got back, I was like, this is really dope. And I can just imagine a coffee table book with dope portraits of Black faculty. And more than just the portraits, but like our stories. And thinking about a conversation that I had with Dr. Leonard Taylor about my work, it was a paper I asked him to review, and conversation that we had, like debriefing that. Or what would be an interesting question is, what kinds of futures do Black faculty imagine in the academy? And how might those align or not with what institutions have in mind for the people that they are recruiting? Because they have a particular end in mind, right? How do those align? Or, you know, if there's a mismatch, what do we do there? And so I decided to take that question and merge it with like photo, video, connect with Charles H.F. Davis, my collaborator, and say, hey, would you be interested in this project? You know, hopping on this project, fellow creative academic. And he's like, yeah, bet, let's do it. And so we set up a studio space here at Ash and was able to sit with some faculty who have been very, I think, foundational in some of the things that we've been thinking about, and asked them a couple of questions. And then we were able to shoot a bunch of headshots for people who want to be a part of the project. And so we're looking forward to continuing to do that in this space, at AERA, ACPA, all the conferences. But it's not just going to be specific to higher ed. This will be Black faculty from across disciplines.
So with that project and centering the voices of Black faculty and kind of this world building, in what ways could we look to explore the voices of those futures who were stolen?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this question. I was asked this question on Wednesday. Shout out to Natasha back there who posed this question to me initially. What immediately came to mind was some literature that I was reviewing talking about the leaky pipeline and how you may come in as an assistant professor, but a lot of people, they leave the field. Either they're advised to leave the field or they're like, no, this is not what I want to do. Some people have lost their lives because of the stress that we experience, right, and the toll that it takes on our bodies. And so I've been thinking about that question since Wednesday, even thinking about people that may have had a desire to become faculty but were encouraged to go another way because somebody didn't see that in them. And so I've just been thinking, like, what do we do with that? I think those narratives are important. They're important to share. They're important for Black doc students who maybe don't have the support that they would want, where Ash or CP specifically is the only supportive space that they experience in their doc programs. And so I've been thinking about how can I tell that story? How do I want to tell that story? So I know a lot of people have asked me, like, oh, what's the next documentary? I mean, I made a documentary, right? But I don't consider myself a documentarian because my work is more than just that. And so just thinking about how we can lean into just thinking, like, there isn't always a perfect response. There's room for us to just sit and think and reflect. And when the time is right, I believe my spirit will be led as to, like, what that project is to illuminate those voices of those who never made it to the field or those who left the field or died within the field. Because, I mean, you know, we love our work, and these institutions can never love us back. Mm-hmm. We saw that at Temple. Mm-hmm. President dies on the stage. Moment of silence. Program continues. Everything goes on as normal. Y'all, people are dying, and these institutions will go on without us. But our families, our friends, our communities, those will have holes in them that are not easily filled, right? And so thinking just about the cost. So I'm very committed to doing work that feels good to me and in ways that are, I don't want to say unique to me, because I don't necessarily think that things that I'm doing are unique to me, but things that feel good to me and that bring me joy. Yeah, I made a documentary because it was something I wanted to do. I wasn't trying to show it at Ash. I wasn't trying to go on tour with it. I was just trying to say, this is really cool that we get to sit around this bonfire every 2 weeks and we get to love each other and pour into each other. And maybe people should see this. And if nobody else cares about it, then at least I did it because it was something I wanted to do. And maybe I'll play it for my kids when they get older. And they probably won't care, but it's fine. So it's something special about just doing something that just makes your soul happy. And what comes of it from other people, let that be what it is. But let's not be afraid to take those sorts of risks.
Yeah, I think just in response to, like, hearing how you're thinking about it, it sounds like a very iterative process. And I'm wondering, like, how do you grapple with that iterative process that sounds natural, innate to you, in a space where it's not, like, appreciated as an innate way of being? But, like, you're creating space, carving out space for it to be something that you can do and succeed at, and, like, just, like, I guess the tensions between, you know, a place that doesn't appreciate that and that being an authentic way of showing up for you.
Yeah. So thank you for your question. I'll start by saying, and it's like, as soon as I said it about the risk, that's not being afraid to take a risk, I also have to say I'm privileged to be in a space where I can take risk, both at my institution, so having the kinds of scholarship that I want to do be supported by the administration, but then also having certain protections at home, right? So I am a part of a two-income household. So if the academy doesn't necessarily value my creative work or what have you, and I, let's say, lose my job or whatever, it'll be a struggle, but I'll be okay. And so I'm sort of just thinking through, I'm always cautious to think about how I encourage people taking risks, because not everybody has the privilege to take those kinds of risks. So, which is why I said in the beginning, people were like, oh, is this documentary going to count for tenure XYZ? I was like, I don't know. I wasn't planning for it to at all, because I know that that is not the currency of the academy. It's citations, it's peer review journal articles, XYZ. And so for my whole career as a tenure track assistant professor, I've just been trying to do both. I have space for my creative work. That's my playtime, if you will, right? Like if I'm like, oh, I am just stuck or I don't really feel like working today, I'll work on creative stuff because that part doesn't feel like work to me. But I am still also writing papers and a part of writing groups and things like that. Being in community helps my process a lot. So not that I can't think alone, but I just think being able to bounce ideas off of people has always been generative to me. And so that's a big part of my process. But it is this back and forth thing. I might go back and change something completely with this new project that we're doing. We may make some different decisions based off what we experienced here. And that's okay. It's okay to abandon the plan and come up with something else or course correct. That's a part of the creative process. It's also a part of the writing process. And I think we have to just make space to honor that.
I know that the creative side is very nourishing for you. And I'm wondering, through doing this project and also with the documentary, how do you nourish your spirits? You care so much about the project, but how do you create enough nourishing space for yourself so that you're not completely overwhelmed with the work that you're doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. Being in community nourishes me. I am a people person, even when I'm not a people person, right? So we may have all have those moments where you're like overstimulated, but even when I'm overstimulated my alone time, there's something special about just being able to just go lay on a friend's couch. We don't have to say anything to each other. It's just like, I'm gonna just come over and take a nap on your couch. This is something I could do at my own house, but it's something about just being in community, right? I don't always do the best job at taking care of myself, but I feel like I do a good job at taking care of my community, and my community takes care of me. We take care of each other. So I know we're in a time where like self-care is trending, and I do think there's a place for that, but I think it's something even more beautiful of us pouring into each other, encouraging each other to rest or figure out what rest looks like or unpack why we can't rest and why we're so busy all the time. So that's the part that nourishes me, is being able to have people that I can do life with. Like, yeah, we can talk about all these academic conferences and papers and language and things, and we can also just do nothing, or we can also just go kick it and have a good time, but we're going through life together, and that has been nourishing to me and crucial to my creative process.
Can we give it up for the brilliant Dr. Candace Hall? Thank you for doing this. Thank you for dropping the gems. Process a takeaway that we've had from our conversation and thinking about it, because I think I might have asked you like, what documentary is next, right? And so I really appreciate you naming that, like, you're not about to put yourself in a box, like, right? Like, that is not the identity that you're taking on, and rejecting what other people are putting onto you. So thank you for that reminder. What did you take away, Miss?
I love us, man. Like, I do. Like, I just think anytime you think that you have predicted the ways that we're moving, we pivot. We move in a completely different direction in a way that you wouldn't have even imagined before. Full disclosure, we had breakfast this morning, and I was talking about Lissa Stapleton Ramirez, okay? I did want to say her name right now because, like, she's doing stuff right now that I'm like, oh, my God. Like, I would not have imagined. I'm not going to say what she's up to because some of it might be private, but, like, she's just creating in a way that I would not have even imagined. And also, wow, like, setting the stage for what is possible in a way that people wouldn't have even considered before in the academy, and owning your stuff and not letting institutions own it for you. Like, that's what I took away from Candace today. Like, not letting this thing own you, reimagining, redirecting, showing people how they can do it too, and doing it in a way that allows them to be themselves.
Should we get into what's problematic?
We shall.
So on the podcast, the What's Problematic segment is me ranting. So my rant for today is I would really appreciate for folks to stop asking us that are in the state of Florida, why are we still there? Or why do we work there? Or why do we go to school there? Florida, Texas, Georgia, you know, any other anti-CRT, anti-DEI, anti-trans state. What I would appreciate is to reframe the question and ask, you know, how are you taking care of yourself? In what ways can I be supportive of the resistance or what's happening in that particular state? Turning up your nose for people that are in the trenches of this anti-DEI legislation is really just doing more harm. You're not contributing to really thinking about how we can navigate and even resist what's currently happening. And oftentimes the question of why are you still there is rooted in a judgment call, and it just ain't helpful. There are students, faculty, staff, administrators that might have the privilege to move or free themselves from states or anti-DEI legislation. Some great, you know, liberal progressive oasis does not exist, right? So if you think that your state is the most progressive or liberal, there are still people in those states that are under oppressive systems. And we can be strategizing and having some coalition together around what this looks like. I know we're a problematic state, but don't sell us off, the United States. All of our states and institutions and communities do harm to marginalized people. Mm-hmm. How do we disrupt, dismantle, and live out people's full humanity in a way that we're not doing harm? That's my rant today, and that's what's problematic.
Can I add something
to
that?
Go ahead.
Well, I think there's a danger in romanticizing who's liberal and who's not, because that's when people get killed. I don't understand why we think that there are states that have any interest in people that are marginalized, because they don't exist. I'm sorry, to your point. So I think living through the nostalgic lens in the contemporary context is weird to me, because that lets me know that you're not in touch at all with what people are going through, geographically speaking. So, yeah, let's stop that shit.
Appreciate you.
Appreciate you, too.
So, Shauna, them jokes of the week. Give it to me, give it to me, give it to me.
So I had to turn my screen so you couldn't see me. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's see how this goes. I wrote these at 4 o'clock this morning. You ready?
I'm ready. Give it to me, give it to me, give it to me.
Do you want to know why I feel so motivated in my Tesla?
Why?
Because it's on self-drive.
It's always the ones you got to think about. Okay, come with a little more heat.
Let's see how this goes.
No for shizzle my nizzle?
No, there's one down there. There's one I'm like, I don't got to feel the temperature of the room to ask that one. We'll see. Plastic surgery used to be so rare. People get Botox and barely lift an eyebrow now.
That one was good.
What did the full glass of water say to the empty glass of water?
Full glass to the empty glass. I don't know. What did it say?
You look drunk.
No, that's good. That's good. That's good. That's good.
You you know I had to sprinkle this one. I've been fucking with him this season. Who is Terrence Howard's favorite Marvel character?
Okay, hold on. Marvel, okay. Because I be getting these Terrence Howard ones.
Because it's obvious.
Iron Man.
We could do that one, too. I said Spider-Man. and what does Drake cuddle with at night?
His feelings.
A take care bear.
Snaps for the jokes of the week.
Okay, so we're going to go into affirmations and celebrations. And this is a little interactive if you're able, right? Like if you're able, just make yourself known to the best of your ability. If you've recently experienced a personal milestone, like a birthday, you ran a marathon, adopted a dog, bought a plant. Anybody? Okay. You found ways to center yourself, ways that are healthy and sustainable.
I need some notes.
Mm-hmm. You have encountered what on the surface felt like rejection, but emerged as protection. You've treated yourself with kindness, grace, and empathy today and or this week. Yeah. You've allowed yourself to experience the benefits of forgiveness or authentic joy. And you've been able to successfully honor your boundaries and needs.
Okay. Whole therapy session.
I just thought it was really...
These are some journal prompts for you, for your flight home.
These are celebrations. Yes. Like, this is affirmation celebrations, and I, people are winning awards. I think that's great. Publishing, dissertation, proposals, defenses, gotten to grad school. Like, yes. And also.
We have to normalize this, yes. Right? And those celebrations of joy or opportunities where we chose us, mm-hmm. Right? Those are opportunities to reframe because you almost feel guilty when you do it. And affirming it and it being aspiration recenters what that means for us.
Mm-hmm. So celebrate yourselves today.
So we close today's recording recognizing that you are certainly worthy and not in that bullshit kumbaya sort of way. So success is liking yourself, liking what you do, and liking how you do it. Dr. Maya Angelou.
Before we close, and I'm so glad you took that Gabrielle Union thing out. Before we close,
you're so shady.
We'd like to give a special thank you to Ash, particularly Jason Gilbo, for making today possible and also sending love-filled birthday wishes to our editor, Tia. Yay. She's defending her proposal soon, right? Mm-hmm. So send her some positive energy. Yeah. And we hope you have a fantastic day on your birthday, Tia.
Thank y'all.
Mommy and Uncle Cameron.